There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE SIPC.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Despite decades of struggle and toil, the hard fact remains women's wages in America still lag far behind men's. Today, right now, in the year 2002, women on average make 76 cents for every dollar earned by a man. And recent studies show the wage gap is actually widening for many women. A new report from the General Accounting Office shows the earnings gap between male and female managers has grown wider since 1995, and that women are underrepresented in senior management in virtually every professional field. Tonight, we're looking at gender, wages, and the glass ceiling. Are American women losing ground? Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney has introduced the Equal Rights Amendment to the House every year since she's been in office, but this year she says she may just have enough votes to bring it to the floor. I asked Congresswoman Maloney why she's still pushing the ERA.
Well, it's like the First Amendment. Why have the First Amendment? I tell you, it's important both symbolically and substantively. Mm-hmm. Equality never becomes antiquated. It should be a fundamental part of our Constitution.
But I think there's a perception out there that to some degree we've moved on, we've come closer to the kind of equality that the ERA was initially composed to help us achieve. You think there's still room to go?
Oh, there's still tremendous room to grow. And one of the areas that has really gained a lot of support for it is a study that Congressman Dingell and I just released that showed literally that women have lost ground in the last 5 years. So we went back and did a survey of mainstream jobs for women. We surveyed 10 different industries where over 71% of women are employed. What was shocking about it is that it showed that women had literally lost ground between 1995 and 2000. In all 10 of the industries we studied, and in 7 of the 10 industries, the earning gap between full-time women and men managers actually widened.
So you're saying the position of women in the workplace is actually deteriorating?
Particularly in management.
We're going to talk about that study this hour. Help us understand how the Equal Rights Amendment would address those problems if it were finally ultimately passed and ratified.
A lot of people are shocked at all these studies that show that women are losing ground, that they aren't doing so well. I know when I began working, I was at 52 cents to the dollar. Now we're at 76 cents to the dollar. We got a raise, but it's still unfair for comparable work. And what's important about it is, why should you be shocked that women are paid less when they don't have equal standing in the Constitution?
Explain that to us.
The area where women have equal standing in the Constitution with men is with the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. And when you have constitutional standing, you're on firm ground. And we've passed many important laws. We've passed Title IX, Title VII, the anti-discrimination law for pregnancy. But these laws can be rolled back. They can be changed. It's only when you have a constitutional amendment that you have full standing. Now, if you went out and asked Americans whether or not they felt that men and women should be treated equally in terms of their opportunities, people would say, of course women should be treated equally. Yet, we don't have equal standing in the Constitution.
Well, Carolyn Maloney, for those listeners who haven't followed this as closely as you have, that may be hard to understand. The Constitution guarantees rights for all Americans of all genders and races, etc.
Well, we're not protected now. And many people say, oh, we don't need the Women's Equality Amendment because we have the 14th Amendment. But that has never been interpreted to grant equal rights on the basis of sex in the same way that the Women's Equality Amendment would.
So give us an example. If the Equal Rights Amendment were finally passed and became the law of the land, how might that impact workplaces in a way that would change, let's say, the wage gap you've described?
Well, if you were supposed to treat women equally, then women in like jobs would be paid the same as their male counterparts.
That would be required by law, and you say it's not now. With the ERA, there would be room to sue if someone believed they weren't being paid equally to their male counterparts?
Yes, absolutely, and it would also set an attitude in the country. Some people say it would not mean anything. But all of these studies show that women are not doing as well as their male counterparts, and in fact, they're showing that in some areas they've lost ground.
What kind of support are you finding among your fellow congressmen and women?
Well, we have over 201 co-sponsors.
You need 218. Can you get them?
Oh, well, we're working on it. You need two-thirds to pass a bill in a constitutional amendment, and then it has to go back and be ratified by 38 states.
It was just three states short
last
time.
Yes, it was ratified by 35 states before.
Do you feel a groundswell, or do you feel lonely in pushing the ERA cause?
Very few bills before Congress have 201 co-sponsors. And it's an important bill, I mean, because equality is something that we should never stop fighting for.
You've introduced the ERA before.
Yes, I have. I have introduced it every year that I've been in Congress. And what I always say is women's issues are really family issues, because in two-thirds of American families where women work, women make 50% or more of the salary. There are many single mothers. So if a woman is discriminated against in her wages, then you're discriminating against her child, against her husband. And it's just plain wrong. It's time we did what most Americans support, which is grant equality and equal treatment for all.
Carolyn Maloney is a representative to the U.S. Congress from Manhattan. Since they first entered the American workplace, American women have become very familiar with a glass ceiling of attitudes and organizational barriers that can stymie job advancement. A century of marching for suffrage, burning bras, and toughing it through boot camps still hasn't brought women the most tangible symbol of equality, equal pay for equal work. And if recent studies are accurate, for many women, historic advances may be eroding. Today, families are more dependent on women's wages than ever, but those wages continue to lag behind men's. Are opportunities for women getting worse, not better? Is the glass ceiling hardening? To help us sort through a slew of recent reports, we're joined by Martha Burke. She's chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations and co-founder and president of the Center for Advancement of Public Policy. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome and good evening, Martha Burke.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks for being with us. And from Providence, Rhode Island, our on-point guest news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon. He's director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Good evening, Lewis Gordon.
Good evening.
Martha Burke, help us in here to this GAO report in particular. The way it's characterized by many, including Congresswoman Maloney, who was just with us, is that over the last 5 years, or the 5 years after 1995, I guess, is precisely the period that the report covers, women in many positions actually lost ground. What's the picture?
Well, it's obviously not a very good picture. We are concerned about women losing ground in terms of wages. We had been gaining for the last 30 years, although very, very slowly, a penny or two at a time. Actually, we've gained about a dime over the last 10, 15 years. So a penny a year, that's a career for most women.
And you're talking about a penny a year in closing the gap with male wage earners or workers.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're starting your career today and you're making 75 cents on the dollar, when you are nearing the end of your career at the rate we were going, you might be close to parity with me in 25 years from now. Mm-hmm. But we don't think that's fast enough. And this report is indeed alarming, because it is showing that not only are we not gaining, we're losing ground. A lot of the closing of the wage gap in the last few years, we know, had been due to the erosion of men's wages. In other words, the economy had a soft underbelly, as we've all learned the hard way this past year. And men were actually losing ground. So it wasn't that women were gaining. It was just that men lost a little bit. So that narrowed the wage gap, but it didn't help women any.
But the 90s were a boom time. Why would a wage gap open up again in boom time? You're saying men started making more money and women didn't take advantage of it? And I guess we should specify, the GAO report is about women in management positions. Is that right?
That is right. And I don't think it's right for you to say women didn't take advantage of it. Women want to make the most money they can make, just like men do.
Well, I don't mean that they didn't have the desire, but that the facts on the ground would suggest that it didn't pay off to the same degree that it might have for men.
It did not pay off to the same degree. You're absolutely correct. We don't know what all the factors are or were. We do know that there is a persistent bias in the workplace in two ways. Women who are in the same jobs as men, even in female-dominated professions like teaching and nursing, men make more. Male nurses make more than female nurses, the few that are in there, and the same is true for teachers. So that's one of the problems. But the other problem is this persistent gap in so-called women's jobs versus men's jobs. And the best example I can give you, a very clear example there, is one that's often cited by Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton from the District of Columbia, and that is social workers versus parole officers.
Okay.
Social workers are usually women. They're usually of a higher educational level than parole officers, who are usually men, yet the average wage there for those parole officers is a good deal higher.
So you're saying women get slotted into jobs that just come with less money?
Yes. And there still are so many jobs in this country that are called and thought of, and in fact are, women's jobs. Clerical pools, word processing, that sort of thing, is still a huge, huge piece of the workforce. And when we talk about management jobs, we may be talking about things like clerical supervisors, as well as women in the top echelons of the corporation.
So these are not all CEOs we're talking about?
No, this is not all CEOs, although there is a pretty huge wage gap even at that very top level.
Well, I wondered about that. The 90s were famously a time of a kind of winner-take-all economy. Could it be that because we know how relatively few women are CEOs of major companies and even minor companies, is it possible that men's wages among managers skyrocketed because they were riding those boom time salaries that accrued to the very top officers in corporations?
Well, I'm sure that was some small part of it, but the question I would ask more fundamentally is, if men were riding the boom times because they were the top officers, why were they the top officers? Mm-hmm. We know that we still do have a very stubborn wage gap, but also a very, very thick glass ceiling.
What are the whys there?
Women are not promoted at the same level as men, so if men are riding the boom times because they're in the top jobs, we have to ask ourselves, why are so few women in those top jobs?
What's the answer? There are a lot of highly educated, highly motivated women out there with a lot of experience. Why aren't they in the top jobs?
Well, we've known for a long time that this may not be all intentional discrimination. It probably is not. What we know from the Glass Ceiling Commission, which started under George Bush Sr., so it was not a partisan thing, it continued under Clinton, is that people tend to hire folks who are like themselves. So if you're of a certain race and socioeconomic class, you're comfortable with people who are just like you. That translates into guys hire guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit harder for women to get in the door. The Glass Ceiling Commission also found that women were not mentored at the same rate that men were in the top corporations. So they may have gotten in there, but they didn't get pulled up through the ranks by their peers at the same rate. They didn't get the in-house training and education and the exposure to the corporate experiences that might have led to a higher job.
And so we have women making up 46.5% of the workforce, but only 12% of all corporate officers. Lewis Gordon, what do you see going on here? I mean, there are a lot of companies who have been desperate for good talent, and if it was a man or a woman, wouldn't they want to throw it at the challenge at hand?
One would think so, but we are living in times in which we do a lot of doublespeak. When we talk about the period of boom, for instance, it's true that there were men, but we have to say which men. There's a particular group of men. If we look, for instance, in some of the recent studies, for instance, in the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education, what you would find is that the situation for black women have improved tremendously in relation to black men, but that also is particularly deceiving when we think about, for instance, the rates of incarceration and the level of high employment that emerges among black men. When we think about also what is going on around the question of wages, we should think through also the fact that it's become a bad word, the term affirmative action has become a bad word. But in those who look at the relationship of gender and race, it's well known that some of the chief beneficiaries of affirmative action have been specifically white women. Now, within with the attack on affirmative action, what has emerged is a great deal of deregulation, a great deal of throwing populations to market forces. And what we found in the absence of this regulation is that some of the old patterns return. It is interesting that Carol Maloney, for instance, in bringing the Equal Rights Amendment, we have to bear in mind, is bringing up the question of a regulation. Anyway, I could say more on it later.
Well, I'm sure we will. And yet those same market forces did bring a boom for an awful lot of people in the 90s, including some at the bottom. We're going to talk a lot more about the wage gap, the glass ceiling, how American women are faring in the workplace. Women, do you feel yourself underpaid at the office? Are you banging your head on the glass ceiling? Or have you made a decision to opt out of the race? Let us know. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American women in the workplace, and new reports coming out suggesting that for many women, they've actually lost ground between 1995 and 2000, maybe even today. Women, do you feel yourself underpaid at the office? Are women losing ground at work? Do you see the wage gap widening? And how do you explain that? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by our guest news analyst, Lewis Gordon, by Martha Burke. She's chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations. And now from New York by Ann Marlowe. Ann Marlowe is a headhunter, a recruiter for law firms, and a New York City writer. Good evening and welcome, Ann Marlowe.
Thank you very much.
And take us into some of the nitty-gritty of how this works out. We're looking at this GAO report. It's saying the wage gap among managers between the genders has widened. It shows that there's a very large gap between the presence of women in particular industries and the presence of women managers in those industries. Is this all about overarching social prejudices and trends, or are there issues in women's individual personal lives that come into play here?
I would think the latter. I wrote an article about this study, which appeared in National Review Online on January 28th, and I would have to take exception to most of what both Congresswoman Maloney and Martha Burke had to say based on my experience.
Let's hear it.
As a day-to-day recruiter dealing with both women and men and their aspirations and goals in the workplace.
What do you see, Ann Marlowe?
First of all, I would also just like to point out that in the initial New York Times report of the GAO study, Martha Farnsworth-Rich, an economist and former director of the Census Bureau, who went over the study for the GAO, noted that women were equal to men up to about 33 years of age, and then they lost ground.
Right.
And her estimation was that the drop-off occurred because women were apt to scale down their career aspirations when they began having children. And that is indeed a lot of what I find. I find a lot of women who are asking me for part-time or off-partner track jobs when they contemplate having children. I even had a woman the other day who requested a part-time or lower hours job when she plans to be married, as if marriage itself were some form of disability, requiring that she work lower hours.
So you're suggesting that it may be too broad stroked.
Also, I would completely object to the idea that there's systematic discrimination against women in either the law firm world or the investment banking world, which are the two worlds I know from my own work experience.
What do you see in those environments?
I see a commitment to equality, and I see a strong desire on the part of top management to bring women into managerial and partnership positions. And as a matter of fact, you know, anyone who thinks that women are discriminated against should consider what it means that a black man was named the president of Merrill Lynch this past summer.
Mm-hmm.
What has that got to do with women's discrimination, if I could ask?
Deal to do with women's discrimination.
How so, Ann Marlowe?
Because this person is someone who is from a group that has definitely been discriminated against, and that I can vouch for when I worked on Wall Street, although I did not hear anti-women remarks. Perhaps they were made when I wasn't around. I did hear anti-black remarks. And
well, some of the largest sex discrimination cases in history have been settled, as a matter of fact, against Wall Street firms. So I think that it's alive and well on Wall Street.
There have been a couple of high-profile cases, which mainly involve
women. Very high-profile and very, very highly reported.
Martha Burke and Ann Marlowe, let me just jump in. Martha Burke, what do you think about Ann Marlowe's overall critique? She's saying this is not an overall social problem. This is the accumulative impact of individual women making choices in their lives. They want to have children. They want to work less for whatever reason. Do you buy that?
Well, no, I don't buy it. She's just wrong, because all of the wage gap studies, including this one, are about full-time, year-round workers. If you take part-time work into account, then women lose even more. They're down somewhere around 68 cents on the dollar. So, no, we are talking about full-time, year-round workers.
That
now, Anne is talking about
misleading.
A very highly paid segment of the population, lawyers, on some kind of partnership track. Let's remember that most women in the United States workplace, the average woman makes somewhere in the mid-20s in her salary. She goes to work every day. She's got a defined work day, just as most men do. She puts in her time.
You mean she makes $20,000 some dollars?
She doesn't have that partner fast track. So, mm-hmm. So no, I don't buy it.
Okay, well, first of all, it is now normal in about 3 in 10 American families which have dual earners for women to be higher paid than men, okay? Secondly, almost all the studies, and I've looked at a lot of them, both in Europe and the United States, show that up until the time that a woman has children, there is almost no difference in wages paid to men and women.
And may I ask,
about 15%.
And may I ask a question just mm-hmm. on that point? Isn't that also, you're saying about 33 years of age, as I recall, isn't that also about the time at which any cohort of workers would see their salaries or wages begin to spread out as some advance and some didn't?
This is true, too. It depends on the industry, of course. In some industries, it would happen, you know, later. In some industries, it would happen earlier. But mm-hmm. it's definitely true for law. Investment banking, it probably happens even a little earlier.
But Martha Burke also points out the numbers here, and she says, look, these are apples to apples. These are all full-time working people, not people who have decided to opt out in some degree.
I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about numbers based on full-time working people, too. Mm-hmm. I've read dozens of studies about this. There's a lot of work going on in this field, gender gap work.
And what about Martha's point that you may be looking at a kind of workforce elite of law firm employees?
That's what we're talking about.
It's not all we're talking about.
Women making it into managerial ranks.
That's true, but managerial ranks, as Martha describes them and as they're described in this report, go down into some fairly mundane levels of management, not just exalted levels, obviously.
Right. Well, I mean, being a partner at a law firm can range from being paid an exalted amount of money to being paid a nice amount of money. It depends on the firm.
Lewis Gordon, I want to bring you in here. Here we see a kind of range of views of what's going on. Martha Burke is saying we've got discrimination that is operating across a very broad field, and it's leaving women behind. Ann Marlowe is saying, you know, women are making personal decisions that cumulatively are affecting the numbers we're looking at.
This is a familiar debate when one argues the distinction between structures and individuals, but there are ways in which the two can cohere. There have been a study, for instance, by a woman by the name of Renee White on how young women look at risk. And in many ways, what we're looking at are how rational choices are made, how options can be weighed out. And it could be argued that as we go through times where the options begin to decline in relation to what many women may have available to mm-hmm. them in the society, they may begin to make decisions in a very different way that can actually be consistent in terms of the two arguments that are unfolding here.
You mean if they don't see the opportunities they'd like, then they may voluntarily retreat from the field to some degree?
To some degree. And in other words, if there is a glass ceiling, for instance, if we were talking about the legal profession, but it's well known there was a period of a glut of lawyers. So outside, before one even gets into the question of gender discrimination, there's already there are ways in which those who enter that profession may begin to make decisions a little differently. Mm-hmm. But still, in the midst of that, if we're also dealing with the fact that it's without question that in the past two decades, there's been a concerted attack on government intervention into questions of equality. And as we know, as that goes into decline, it's an open door for certain practices to return. And we're seeing a clear-cut example of some of the consequences of these right now.
I would just like to second that. We know the government has cut back drastically on its affirmative action obligations.
Do you think American women still need that, Martha Burke, affirmative action?
Absolutely. And as Lewis pointed out earlier, and he was absolutely right, affirmative action has helped women of all races as much as because it's helped minority men or perhaps more. So when companies feel no obligation whatsoever to have even an affirmative action plan, they're not going to go look for women. They're not going to go look for persons of color because nobody's looking over their shoulder. They revert back to hiring people like them that are usually white men.
Martha Burke and Marlo, I want to turn to the phones. There are a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Kristen is on the line. Welcome, Kristen. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just had a couple of points, just 2 points. One is that I wonder how much women play a role in this in terms of either applying for a particular management position or being eligible for promotion, in that they might be feeling fortunate to actually be getting that position or the promotion and less concerned about the actual salary level and how that compares to a male colleague.
You mean they may be less assertive in going after the bigger wage?
Right, less aggressive, less, and actually in the corporations that I've worked at as well, it's actually, you know, considered illegal to discuss wages, especially, you know, somebody, a colleague within that particular corporation. And in some ways, it might be difficult to compare to an equivalent position outside of your company. Mm-hmm. So you don't have a great sense of, you know, where do I stand and is this equal to a male, you know, colleague that might be a part of
it. It's a great question. How do you even begin to know? Kristen, thank you for your call. Anne Marlowe, in your experience, you're recruiting people into the legal profession. Do you see women pushing less hard for the high dollar figure?
Absolutely. And I think it has a lot to do with cultural norms. How they came to be is one question, but what we do with them as they are now is another question. I think the government ought to guarantee equality of opportunity, not equality of outcomes. Outcomes are up to individuals. I personally wish more women were in high managerial ranks, but my personal opinion has nothing to do with the choices which women are making of their own free will. And what women are telling me is they care a lot less for money than they do for free time. And some of these are not even women who are married, much less have children.
Martha Burke, are you even willing to consider that? Please do.
I'd like to respond to the caller. Insofar as this disclosure issue is concerned, she is absolutely right that it is illegal in many workplaces that you can get fired for discussing salary.
So people don't know who's making what.
So people don't know what others are making. Mm-hmm. Senator Tom Harkin has a bill on Capitol Hill right now called the Fair Pay Act. And the Fair Pay Act would mandate that companies disclose gross statistics, not any one salary on a bulletin board, but just gross statistics about what they pay men and what they pay women in different job categories. Mm-hmm. We think that would go a long way toward closing the wage gap because women would be able to see how they're getting along relative to the guy standing next to them. And companies that have some built-in discrimination in their pay scales and may not even know it would see that as they compile these statistics.
Sort of show
so there
up on their
are
bell
legislative
curve there.
Remedies here.
Mm-hmm. There might be. Ben is on the line. Welcome, Ben. You're on the air.
My call. I just wanted to add a piece of anecdotal information. I work for a large consulting firm in Boston, and through just sheer accident, my boss is a woman, and she has 15 years of experience in the field. She's just a few years older than I am.
Okay.
I'm in a management position. She makes exactly what I do, and she has significantly more responsibility than I do.
What do you make of that, Ben? Why do you think that situation exists?
I don't know. And it's the only thing. The one thing that strikes me is one of the speakers mentioned the whole idea that, you know, people hire people like themselves, and her counterpart is much closer and much tighter to their boss. So her boss is much friendlier with her peer. And
it sounds like you two were talking and this information came out. What was your boss's response when she found out that she was making the same income as you, her subordinate?
She was very dismayed. Mm-hmm. She was very dismayed. She couldn't understand why, because, you know, why? Why would somebody who has less responsibility make the same amount of money as someone who has more?
Mm-hmm. Ben, it's a fascinating anecdote. Lewis Gordon, please come in here.
This returns to that point. One point I was making earlier about risk. For instance, if one perceives that one has more options in the job market, one could negotiate for a salary in a very different way than if one sees the opportunity as extraordinarily rare. And in many cases, if already the stacks are in such a way that one would go from like to like, in other words, that the category of individuals who would be sought for a position would look more like, say, one if one were a white male employee, the ability to use it as a bargaining chip would be very different than if one were to think of being, for instance, the only woman, particularly in a state or in a particular region in that profession. The idea that if you do not keep this position, you may have to go to another place would really limit how you would negotiate for the factors in terms of salary. Mm. And I've seen it, actually, in academic settings all the time.
Mm. I think Lewis is right. And something I would add, Ben, is that your boss may have actually started at a lower level. We know that women are consistently offered out of college about 10% less than men are offered on their first job. When you start out 10% behind, that difference accumulates over the years. So that is going to also contribute to that wage gap that we see really widening at about age 33 or so. Mm-hmm. So there are other factors, but I think that companies consistently offer women less money to begin with than men.
Except in fields, for example, like the legal field, where there's what is called lockstep pay, and all hires at a given level are actually paid the same amount, which is true at most large law firms in the United States and Europe.
Oh, that's very good news.
If you're in that situation, good for you. Let's turn to the phones again. Adri is on the line. Welcome, Adri. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening.
Adri Calisfer here. I had a question. I read an editorial way, way back for Walter Williams when discrimination against black was a big issue. And he said in a free economy that discrimination cannot exist. It costs money to do so. I work for a big company. We go around the world to buy steel and copper for a fraction of a penny less. And the only color we care about is color green. Now to tell, the congressman is telling me that my boss is an idiot for hiring me at a dollar where he can get somebody else for 80 or 70 cents on the dollar. Even if my boss is such an idiot, his boss certainly would not.
So are you saying you see a business opportunity here in hiring someone cheaper?
So there is no issue.
I don't completely follow.
Adri, I agree with the call.
And Marla, hang on. I want to just share that this is very clear. Adri, you're saying that the corporations are going to reach out and hire these people that they can get at a lower rate, or that they see some value in men that they don't see in women.
Exactly. In a free economy, you cannot afford to discriminate. It costs you money.
Exactly.
So what's the quality you think your corporation sees in men that it doesn't see in women, Adri?
Exactly. So
what is it? What is that quality? What is that value that you think?
There are rational reasons for it.
Such as they look better in a three-piece suit?
Whatever it is. But it is market-driven. If my company was as stupid as the congressman seemed to suggest, then the competition would not be and hire only women.
Okay, Adri. And Marlo, you say you see that.
Well, it's an absolutely classic economic argument, and it's absolutely true. I mean, look, obviously, on a systematic basis, no industry can afford to discriminate because its competitors won't. Its competitors are not going to stand by, and you know.
But these arguments are based
on numbers. Unfortunately, Martha Burke does not seem to be aware of the actual numbers. I'm looking here. I'm sitting in front of a paper.
Martha Burke is very, very aware of the actual numbers.
I am looking here at a paper by the Harvard economist Richard Freeman.
Okay.
Called "The Feminization of Work in the U.S. A New Era for Mankind," April 1999, which I think has already just come out in the Gender and the Labor Market, Econometric Evidence on Obstacles in Achieving Gender Equality. And what Mr. Freeman points out is that wives with hourly earnings greater than the hourly earnings of their husbands now comprise 29% of working wives. That was as of 1996. It's probably better today. That is an 11 percentage point increase over 1980.
And we're going to have to come back and look at this. We've got a short break coming up here. We're talking about the wage gap between men and women, and what is it all about? Why the glass ceiling? Why the wage gap? Women, do you feel yourself underpaid at the office? Younger women, are you as set on a career focus, on career advancement, as your mothers, as the women's lib generation? And older women, do you see the gains you fought for being lost? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the workplace glass ceiling and the wage gap between men and women. Mm-hmm. What puts the steel in the glass ceiling? Men, do you see privilege in your paycheck? Do these statistics reflect reality as you experience it? If it does, how do you explain the gap? Are women still making progress in the workplace or losing ground? And if women are retreating, why? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Martha Burke. She's chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations, by Ann Marlowe, a headhunter, a legal recruiter or recruiter in the law field in New York and a New York City writer, and by our guest news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon, director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Martha Burke, just before the break, Ann Marlowe was saying, look, she agreed with our caller, the market works, and if, these are two, you know, sincerely held opinions, that corporations will hire and pay for value. And if there's a gap, it's a gap, I guess, that suggests in value somehow.
I think that Lewis Gordon and I are both chuckling because we know that the marketplace is informed by many things, and one of those things is historic and actual discrimination. So when we see that the wages, for example, for child care workers are significantly less than animal wardens, that can only be a societal value that has been placed on a male job over a female job. And the example I gave earlier, I think, of parole officers and social workers also informs that. There is no pure marketplace. We know that companies do not operate in a vacuum. Companies get all kinds of corporate welfare. It's not a pure marketplace.
Martha Burke, we have so many callers who want in here. I want to turn to the phones.
Right.
Shana's on the line. Welcome, Shana. You're on the air.
Good evening, everyone.
Hi, good evening.
I just wanted to comment that I think this problem of the wage gap is a more societal issue than affirmative action can really address. I think that families have to make a decision now of one person taking the primary responsibility of child rearing, and the other person takes the primary responsibility of kind of bringing in a higher wage. And often, because of the lack of support from corporations or from benefits packages for families, and specifically women from maternity leave, it ends up being the woman who has to take time off of work to have children.
It's pretty tough to have that family if everybody's working 40 or 50 hours a week, isn't it, Shana?
Exactly, and it's tough even to really make enough money to support a family now if you're only working or if you're only making $120,000 combined.
Mm-hmm. Martha Burke, you must look at this very closely. Wow. Shana, thank you for that call.
How
does this play out?
No, the caller is right in the sense that a lot of what happens to women who do opt out of the workplace is because family priorities are such that the man's already making more, so the economic decision within the family is that the lower wage earner, usually the woman, is going to drop out. But I need to remind the caller and the listeners that these wage gap statistics are not about women who drop out of the workplace. They're for full-time, year-round workers.
But, of course, there is a way in which some women make decisions without dropping out of the workforce that might leave them in a lower-wage position full-time because they have more flexibility, I guess?
No, I think that 90% of the women in the workplace do not have any flexibility, and I think that your callers and listeners out there know that. They have to show up at a certain time, and they can only leave at a certain time. There is rarely any flexibility in the average workplace.
Lewis Gordon?
I should also like to add that I've seen management in a variety of contexts in which one phenomenon has always perplexed me is how individuals are able to move up ranks who actually fail at the jobs they were doing before. And I've seen it in academia, I've seen it in corporate America, and the reality is it's almost consistently around a category of white males. I think there's a myth and an illusion. I'm totally serious. There's a myth. I could give an example. We just had a president at Brown University who did disastrously at different places, and he was able to move up the ladder consistently. I've seen people who have destroyed apartments in American universities who get endowed chairs and move up to the levels of higher management.
So you would say market not work, but you're saying that even incompetent white males are just going to soar up the hierarchy?
I'm saying that there are different factors that play roles in management beyond purely a free market conception of merit or achievement. There are other factors that we have to take seriously, and often these are individuals who move up over individuals who are in a different gender or race category who may be actually better or more excellent. I've seen people of color, for instance, who have performed at many other levels, contributed much to the institutions at which they work, and they do not move up the rank. So if it were
Lewis Gordon, we got it. And thanks. I'm going to keep these phones open because they are so jammed. Ken is on the line. Welcome, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Thank you. I think I'd like to maybe add on to Shana's point a little bit by suggesting that the progress to be made towards closing the wage gap is running up into the limits of what can be achieved by approaching it as a women's rights issue.
Okay. Where do you go then?
Okay. I think we need to approach equal rights and address that in terms of not only women's rights issue, but also men's rights issues.
And how would that apply to closing a wage gap for women, Ken?
Okay. Perhaps a concrete example, and this may not be the only one, but maternity leave is an area where I think we'd all agree it's extremely important, and indeed this country is far behind most of the industrialized world in terms of the recognition and allowances for maternity leave.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that's very expensive for the workforce, and the risk of that expense is borne disproportionately by women because of the fact that we don't extend the same kind of recognition towards men's role as fathers and their role in the family.
So apply that leave just as one example to both men and women. Well, there's a thought, ERA for both genders. I want to move on to Alex on the line, keep people coming here. Alex, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I have to start by saying I'm very much pro-ERA, and I'm the CEO of a small company.
Okay.
And so starting with that perspective, I have to say I'm confused, and perhaps I think this can't be dealt with as one large issue. I know in our company, when we've grown, when we've given bonuses, and when we've had to lay people off, we always take a second effort, and the lawyers tell us to make sure that our female employees are not being singled out, that they're being treated fairly.
Your lawyers tell you so that you don't draw a lawsuit, Alex?
Well, because the law requires that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't, for men, for white men, we don't look at that at all. And so, in our firm, we're phenomenally, you know, lucky to have excellent women and very pleased by the great contributions they make.
So what's your interpretation of the wage gap, Alex?
Well, my interpretation is that there are a lot of laws out there that professional firms seem to be following. I deal with the financial services industry as well, and I deal with very successful, very high-powered women as well.
Exactly.
So you're saying you don't understand why there's a wage gap? Is that it, Alex?
I don't believe it's a uniform factor.
Well, of course it's not uniform, but it seems to be the average. Alex, thanks very much for your call. I'm going to bring one more in. Louise is on the line. Welcome, Louise. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I called in because the comment that you made about the gains that were made 20 years ago by the women's movement, or we're seeing them backslide and disappear.
Well, we're asking.
I see that. I am a physician. I've been in practice almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I see women who are coming out of residency now who've gone all the way through medical school, 3 or 4 years of residency, either choosing not to practice at all and to begin their families, or else to take very part-time or not true career track paths in their medical careers.
And how do you interpret that, Louise, after all that investment in their education?
Quite frankly, part of me is mystified. And part of me is jealous. I went through the my two children at 15 and 17.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I missed an enormous amount of their early childhood.
So do you think that the daughters of the women's liberation generation are making an active decision in the other direction?
I do.
Wow. Louise, thank you very much for your call. Martha Burke, do you see that in your work? That must be hard for you if it is.
Well, regardless of whether individuals make the choice to stay home or not, what we know is that the individuals who do not make that choice, again, and enter that medical workplace full-time, year-round, are being paid less than their male counterparts. It's just a fact of life.
So you're saying leave aside the personal decisions. The overall statistics say even if you're working at the rock face 40, 50, 60 hours a week, you're not going to make the same as the guy
next to you. That's exactly right.
And let's have big government cure it all and tell people exactly what to do.
And Marla, what would your solution be? And our time's running down here, but quickly, how would you confront this gap?
I would like to see women identify more with their careers and take more pride in their achievements, in what they can accomplish, in what they can leave behind them as a career achievement. I think the female physician who just called in ought to be very proud of herself. And I wonder if these women who are basically exiting the workforce at the age of 25 are going to have something to be proud of when they look back 25 years later.
Well, the caller who just called in said she wished she had spent more time with her family, so there's many different decisions to be made. And Marla, our our time is running out. We thank you very much for joining us tonight. Ann Marlow is a writer and legal recruiter in New York City. And Martha Burke, thank you so much for coming on this evening.
My pleasure.
Martha Burke is chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations. She's co-founder and president of the Center for Advancement of Public Policy. Lewis Gordon, last word goes to you tonight.
Well, I don't think in these issues there's a simple question about what each woman will be doing in her life. But the main issue that we have to deal with are the options available through the political resources we have. I noticed that the question of big government was raised, but the point isn't really about big government. The question is about just government. And I do hope that one day we will see just that.
Well, we always see the justice, government, and the marketplace, the old American triad there, always wrestling. To read the General Accounting Office report, a new look through the glass ceiling, go to our website at onpointradio.org. Lewis Gordon, thanks for being with us. Okay. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ernesto Zedillo served as president of Mexico from 1994 to 2000. Yesterday, he spoke at Harvard University about the need for increased aid to developing countries. Here's a brief excerpt from his speech.
Consider the case of the United States. In year 2000, the U.S. provided official development assistance of only 0.1% of its gross national income, the lowest proportion among all donors. Almost one-third went to the four biggest recipients, the biggest one, Russia, then Israel, Egypt, and Ukraine. It is likely that the rest of U.S. aid also includes a significant non-development component, such as the support to fight drug trafficking in Colombia. Second, donors have often used aid label for development to advance their own foreign policy goals or to promote their own exports, rather than to maximize the impact of aid on poverty or growth in the recipient country. Contrary to popular belief, the fact is that aid works well. Pessimists might still argue that strategies are lacking to apply additional aid resources effectively. If good aid does work to reduce poverty in the developing world, then it also makes sense for the industrialized countries' own well-being. The marginal benefits of increasing aid in terms of expanded markets and enhanced security surely outweigh the extra cost. Just consider that the $50 billion needed annually to achieve the international development goals is less than one-tenth of the annual military spending of the U.S. and its allies. My conclusion is that there is no scarcity of sound ideas to fight poverty in the world. Finance is what is lacking. The best opportunity to inject new and vigorous life into international cooperation is just a few days ahead. Next week, in Monterrey, Mexico, the heads of government of more than 50 countries, among them President Bush, will gather at the UN International Conference on Financing for Development. We shall know very soon whether the world's leaders are willing to bet more on multilateralism, on interdependence, on positive engagement, on trade and aid to rise to the big challenges of the opening of this new century. Right now, I am optimistic about the outcome of the conference for several good reasons. Considering its timing and agenda, the mere fact that the conference is taking place is good news. Today's circumstances have brought the topic of international cooperation back to the attention of the governments of industrial countries. Suddenly, quite in contrast with the world of a year ago, there are signs that unilateralism is yielding to multilateralism. This might not last for long, so the world had better grab the opportunity now.
Former President of Mexico, Ernesto Zedillo, speaking yesterday at Harvard. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Mike Garth, Darren Manoogian, and Laura Tenguso, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.